Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, Donald Trump announced the besieged government in Gaza had agreed to disarm, a hopeful sign. But as with all the American president's statements, it's to be taken with liberal amounts of sodium chloride. Andy Worthington's an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Forefathers Band. He is, too, a co-founder of the ongoing Close Guantanamo campaign. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Beanfield. Andy's articles appear at andyworthington.co.uk and at his eponymous Substack site, where I found his recent post, Hamas agrees to disarm, but only if Israel leaves Gaza. Welcome back to the program, Andy.
Thanks, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Well, and happy first Wednesday of the month day, I suppose, or maybe not so happy for the people still in Guantanamo. This is the closed Guantanamo vigil day. How'd it go today?
Well, you know, there were a handful of us in central London outside the Houses of Parliament. I know that our friends in Washington, D.C., outside the White House, and in Brussels, outside the European Parliament, were also holding vigils, and in various other places. So we just do what we can, Chris, really, to light a solitary candle to try to remind the world, which has mostly forgotten, that Guantanamo is still open, that 15 men are still held there. In various states of fundamental lawlessness. And it's incredibly difficult doing this when Donald Trump is the president for the second time, because he seals the prison shut and he has no interest in doing anything about it at all. But we do what we can.
Well, and meanwhile, all of Cuba is a prison of a sort, and increasingly so under Donald Trump. I think the most egregious American president since the beginning of hostilities towards the revolution 66 years ago or so.
Yeah, well, doesn't he just so casually, you know, with these terrible people that he has around him as well, just make things worse, do things that are unimaginable, you know, across the globe. I mean, in Cuba, Venezuela, Iran.
I want to talk about Gaza, of course, as the lead-in. But before we get there, I'm just reading an AP report that dozens have been arrested last week in London in demonstrations in support of Palestine action. What, Andy, if anything, does the sentencing of yet another group of anti-genocide activists as terrorists have to do with that support?
When direct action, when any organization is prescribed as a terrorist organization, it literally means that according to the law, if you espouse anything that can be construed as support for that group, then you can be arrested and tried and imprisoned under the terrorism legislation. And, you know, as I was saying that to you, Chris, I was thinking about two of the words that spring most immediately to mind from the last 20 odd years, which is that if you were to espouse support for Al-Qaeda or for ISIS, then, you know, I think that we can say that there are people who recognize that, the prescription of those groups made some kind of sense. What we're dealing with here is a direct action group. What direct action groups do is that they engage in criminal damage against the enterprises that they target. And, you know, Palestine Action is part of a long tradition of people driven by their consciences to cause damage to military equipment to try and prevent them being used in warfare, or most acutely in an ongoing genocide. And this is the most acute example of an ongoing genocide that we've seen in our lifetimes. And that's the problem. When you make this group into a terrorist organization, then what the government didn't count on, and in one level it's very amusing, what they didn't count on was the fact that there would be a mass mobilization, mostly of elderly people, many of whom have held respectable positions within the British establishment, who would decide that it was worth their while to get arrested by holding up handwritten signs that say, "I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action." And that's what's still going on here. It makes us, I think, laughingstock around the world. But of course, the darker side of that is is all to do with how fundamentally wrong it is to confuse criminal damage with terrorism. I mean, that's really the bottom line.
It gets even more confusing, Andy, when the terrorists are no longer terrorists. Now the former head of ISIS is the president of Syria, and the president of America voices ardent support, even somewhat homoerotic support, depending on how you read his comments.
I wonder whether the founder of Palestine Action, Huda Amouri, whether she, you know, will be offered the presidency of some benighted country somewhere at some point as a reward for having become a terrorist leader.
I doubt that, but if she was, she would probably be received in the West more like Nelson Mandela was, and continue to be called a terrorist or terrorist supporter. She's not at least been imprisoned. I saw a terrific interview with her on Double Down News, a really terrific site out of Britain, not long ago. She's very well spoken and laid out the case with great style and grace. But these people are still continuing, these elders that you mentioned are still continuing to be arrested. And I read, I think just yesterday, in the early days of these arrests, with people holding up like placards saying, "Oh, well, I support Palestine Action," or little clever plays on words. But now people were being arrested in this most recent violation by the Metropolitan Police in London for just sitting there and being near these people, not even raising placards, not even saying anything at all.
Yeah. I mean, two of my friends who have been arrested multiple times, one of my friends was telling me about this, and we couldn't understand whether the police or police operation was just incompetent, or whether they were deliberately trying to arrest people for no good reason. I mean, my friend said, you know, if that's the case, then actually it's playing into the hands, because what people want is to clog up the legal system with cases that nobody wants to deal with. And, you know, this adds another level of idiocy to what they've been doing to date. I mean, the context, Chris, is that, you know, they've summoned over 1,500 people to come to the court in London to have their hearings about, you know, potentially these people can be given 6-month sentences. But the system is so scrambled that some people received notifications on the same piece of paper asking them to come to court and also asking them not to come to court. So, you know, the whole thing, like I say, the whole thing is chaos, and so much of it is just risible. I mean, it, you know, it's hard not to laugh at it, but the deeper problem with it is much more serious, that the government has put itself in this idiotic position where, theoretically, according to the law that it passed, you know, it's supposed to be imprisoning all of these people for at least 6 months. And in the maximum cases, you know, you can get a 14-year sentence. And what some of the activists are now doing is explicitly calling for, you know, saying, "I support Palestine Action, and I think you should too." And there's, you know, there's a retired vicar in her 80s who was arrested for this. And the other day they arrested Sir Jonathan Porritt, who was the former head of Friends of the Earth. He was an environmental advisor to Prince Charles, now King Charles III. He has been in the head of a college in Oxford. I mean, you don't get much more pillar of the establishment than him. And he was duly arrested the other day and very eloquently spoke about why that was wrong.
Well, Andy, in England now you have the ascension of a new prime minister after a string of, I would say, morally retarded candidates in that position. Nobody has voted for him at all in any capacity. Are these arrests a way of signaling, do you think, to people that, well, yeah, there's a new prime minister in town, a new sheriff in town, and not only is he not going to change things for the better, it's going to get worse?
I think that it just actually is just carrying on without there being any influence as to the fact that the head of the puppet has changed. You know, these things have their own momentum. I mean, the requirement for Andy Burnham to do something would be for him to say, You know, we shouldn't have passed this law. This is an act of legal overreach, and it's causing problems that are, you know, that are well worth worrying about. But he hasn't done that, and I don't expect that he's going to do anything, to be honest. I mean, he made a kind of lame apology for the way that the Gaza campaign was handled at the beginning. He was ushered into his place because of the high-level supporters of Israel within the party. So it's no change from Keir Starmer in any way. And the most pessimistic people seem to be suggesting that he's even more controlled than Starmer was by the pro-Israel elements. I mean, and, you know, both him and Starmer were also members of the group Labour Friends of Israel. So no change, Chris, I don't think. I'd be very surprised to see him striking out. You know, the impression that we're supposed to get of him is that he's the brand new leader and he's going to do some things. But, you know, even if he wanted to, I think his hands are tied, because this is a party that is in paralysis, that is in a permanent authoritarian frenzy, and that is doing everything that it can still to wipe itself out in the next general election.
Well, his early appointments seem to reinforce what you're saying. There's some pretty odious characters in there as far as this goes, as far as Palestine and Gaza especially.
Yeah, he kept the same Home Secretary, the woman who introduced the prescription. She's been shuffled to another place. You know, he appointed he's appointed as his chancellor the defense minister, a man who, you know, a man so unmemorable, but has been in the Labour Party, high up in the Labour Party for decades. And, you know, all of that would seem to suggest that what they'll want to do is make sure that the entire economy of the UK is directed towards war. you know, more money for Israel, more money for endless wars. I mean, it's absurd.
Well, and we're seeing this in Canada, too, in lockstep. This seems to be an internationally agreed course of action between the so-called Five Eyes countries and the European Union. The big push now, it seems, in every country to move to a so-called wartime footing.
Yeah, which none of them can do, because nobody's economy is actually strong enough to do that. And all it's going to do is alienate voters more and more, you know, completely understandably, Chris, because, you know, the problems that people face economically are getting worse and worse. The huge problem of the biggest war in human history, which is human beings' war against a livable climate, is getting so noticeably bad. You know, apart from the diehard skeptics in this country, Chris, people are getting alarmed and worried. You know, I see it. You know, people talk about it now. London has been burning up. We didn't have a drop of rain in the whole of July. You know, climate scientists are sounding alarms so loudly because a year ago, no one was expecting this now. And if you go back 2 or 3 years, no one was expecting it until the 2030s. It's 2026. You know, who are all of these idiots in the center, on the right of politics? Who are all these idiots who are insisting that that a spectral war, apparently based around their Russophobia, needs to be the driving center of everything political? They're so out of touch with the people. I just can't believe it.
Well, not only are the vulnerable literally dropping dead because of the heat in Europe, and the fires going on there, especially in Spain and Italy, and yet I see a report that firefighting helicopters can't get off the ground because the parts they require have been stopped because of the European embargo against Russia, because they're Russian made, and because, you know, they can't get the parts. And here, too, where I'm talking to you from on the west coast of North America, in Canada, so-called, the fires are burning closer and closer to where I sit, luckily on the island, off of the mainland. But there's huge fires south of us. And did you hear about Donald Trump blaming Canada for the smoke of the forest fires from Canada going south into New York and that, and causing disruption? And But not a word do I hear from, you know, him about the forest fires burning Washington State right to our south. You know, the worst fires they've had in living memory, and the smoke is coming north, and we're not hearing anything from the bellowing buffoon south of us. Well, anyway, I'm getting off track here, Andy. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with Andy Worthington. Andy's an English journalist. He's an activist. He's an author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band, among other things. He's also co-founder of the ongoing Close Guantanamo campaign, which we talked about. His books include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Beanfield. We got to talk about that book one time, Andy. I didn't know anything about that, and I assumed it was some ancient thing, you know, like it has a quaint title. And reading about more about it, I see, oh, this is appropriately timed even for now, even though it was something that did happen in another century.
Yeah, it'd be great to talk about it at some point. I mean, it was in some ways, Chris, you know, the start of the authoritarianism in the UK that has only got worse. You know, authoritarian laws are rarely repealed. So the reason that our countries are now, you know, sitting somewhere in some far-right bubble is because of illiberal laws that have been passed generation after generation. And this is, you know, 40 years of British history. And yeah, so it is relevant. But
if there's anything about getting old that we can, you know, sort of take solace in, is the sense of actual lived memory. And
yeah.
I've been doing this show, as I mentioned to Eve just a minute ago, for almost 30 years. And yeah. You know, it's one thing after the other. But if you look back at it, you know, you can see a discernible pattern. And it seems to be swirling, and the swirling seems to be getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And there seems to be at the very center of it a dark hole, something similar to what you'd see in a toilet, or as you say over there, a loo. We seem to be circling the loo. Andy's website is andyworthington.co.uk. And that's where I read his article, Hamas Agrees to Disarm, But Only If Israel Leaves Gaza. Now, it's been a long time getting around to this, Andy, because this is actually where I started the introduction. But so Trump, but there was somebody said, you know, from Washington, somebody put a word in his ear that, okay, there's going to be peace. What's the story about?
Well, so the story goes back to, you know, Trump's 20-point peace plan for the future of Gaza, which, you know, was introduced in October. And, you know, it did noticeably do something at the beginning. I mean, at that point, and it maybe is hard for us now to remember, Israel was, you know, accelerating its exterminatory Armageddon policies against Gaza to an almost unthinkable degree. You know, it was on the ground in Gaza City, blowing up everything in sight, and it was still murdering 60 to 100 civilians every day. And the bomb stopped, and the hostages were released, which was an extraordinary concession by Hamas because it, you know, it kind of left them powerless. And then what was supposed to happen was that Israel was supposed to withdraw to an arbitrary line that meant that they still, happily for them, occupied, you know, over half of the Gaza Strip. There was supposed to be 600 lorries of humanitarian aid delivered every single day. And Israel absolutely refused to cooperate with any of the aspects of the ceasefire deal, whereas the Palestinians did. And the second phase of the ceasefire deal was supposed to involve Hamas disarming, Israel withdrawing steadily from the whole of the Gaza Strip, and efforts being allowed for the reconstruction of Gaza, which, according to Trump's plan, and, you know, everyone agreed to this, Chris, and it was then also kind of pushed onto the UN Security Council to pass as a resolution, which they did. And according to all of this, you know, the phase two talks were supposed to involve all of these things overlapping. So the steady withdrawal of Israel, Hamas disarming, and a new Palestinian committee that was appointed being allowed into Gaza to begin working with foreign troops from supportive countries who wanted to help reconstruct Gaza. And all along, what has happened on this second phase is that Israel put its foot down and said, no, without the total disarmament of Hamas immediately, nothing is going to happen. And of course, that would be a kind of suicide note on Hamas's part, because why would you trust that Israel won't just kill you easier when you literally don't have any weapons left? And the story from last week, I mean, it involved a particular, for me, what was particularly interesting was a U.S. official. He was unnamed in the Israeli newspaper report, but he was very, very critical of the way that Israel has failed to cooperate with all of the things that it agreed to. You know, that was kind of refreshing to hear that from somebody on the inside, rather than all of us on the outside saying, you can't trust them. They never, ever, ever, ever do what anybody asks them to do, even when they've agreed to it. They don't. They will not accept being told anything by anybody. They will not stop murdering Palestinian civilians, because that is their only purpose. That's all the state of Israel stands for now, is to murder innocent civilians every damn day in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon. And so it's already started unraveling, because the Israelis won't play ball. They had the Board of Peace had a meeting with them and came out of that and said, oh, yes, actually, this isn't a complicated story. Hamas has to completely disarm before Israel is even going to consider thinking about withdrawing at all from the Gaza Strip. So I think the thing has already collapsed, Chris.
And this Board of Peace.
What makes me incandescent with rage is that at the weekend, after this had been announced, in a temper tantrum, Israel started bombing Gaza like crazy. 20 people, I think, were killed, civilians, children. A mother was blown apart so that her unborn baby was thrown from her body. What more can we do with these monstrous, depraved people to get them to stop? You know, there's no interest. You know, Trump has set up this half-hearted thing. Obviously, you know, he wanted to be praised by everybody and then he lost interest. But there is a process here that is attempting to do something that doesn't just involve relentless Israeli extermination. And it seems that, you know, Netanyahu has put his foot down again and the Americans have caved. And, you know, we're just back in the same miserable position as before.
Well, and you cite from since the October 2025 20-point plan was announced, more than 3,500 violations by Israel of the agreement, more than 1,300 Palestinian civilians killed. The yellow line has crept from its 53% of what was formerly recognized as Gaza Strip to 70%+ now, and people remaining being squeezed inexorably, as has, I think, always been the plan. And I don't think they even made a secret of that in Israel. Hardly any of the aid that they promised would be allowed. This is in preparation for the disarming of Hamas. But now they're starting it from the beginning, it seems like. Well, none of the first agreement matters, that now Hamas, in order to move on, has to go along with the actions that they said they would agree to, given Israel's abiding by the agreement, which they clearly haven't. But now I hear that, and in your article, you talk about that so-called roadmap, and then that word itself is so laden. Oh no, we're going to a roadmap, and this takes me back to Yasser Arafat and Oslo, and the roadmap for peace.
Well, we have, except that, you know, since October the 7th, 34 months ago, what Israel has done is indescribably worse than anything imaginable. I mean, it's worse than the Nakba. You know, 15,000 people were killed there, 750,000 people lost their homes, the start of Israel's genocidal project. But no, they've never done anything like this. You know, all those times that they, you know, that phrase, mowing the lawn, they used to, I mean, what a disgusting thing to say. That's what they used to say when, you know, Hamas would lob some rockets their way, and then they would embark on these horrible attacks on Gaza, which we all saw in the 2000s, in the 2010s. The longest one of those, Chris, lasted for 44 days. It's now 1,035 days. Yeah. Netanyahu, whenever you see him talk about it, still talks about how, you know, this is an endless war until Hamas is eliminated. This is all that Israel lives for, is to kill, to kill, to kill. You know, I know parts of their economy are still strong because they are experts in the dark arts of tech and weaponry. But people are leaving Israel in droves. Significant numbers of people are leaving Israel. There's a brain drain because, you know, why would there not be? And yet nothing can stop them. It's so beyond. It's almost beyond words. What can I say, Chris? It's sickening. It's sickening in a way that we need a new word to describe how sickening it is.
Well, you quote Linda Mamoun, who wrote in her Twitter page, in a normal world, the country that committed genocide would be the one required to demilitarize.
Yes, exactly.
According to this roadmap, though, it demands Hamas become entirely vulnerable. It reminds of the former Syrian President Assad getting rid of his weapons, or before him, Libya's Gaddafi agreeing to disarm and the fates that they met.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. And, you know, I mean, Hamas have been very careful to say that they're, you know, that they're not going along with it. They are prepared to hand over these weapons to be stored if a Palestinian committee is allowed in to take over. And I mean, for all I know, they're thinking, well, if we do that, Israel will destroy the weapons anyway. But if we get a Palestinian committee in to actually run Gaza that isn't us, then we have still some measure of autonomy. And I can understand that kind of reasoning. And I can understand that, not from Trump and not from Jared Kushner and all of these repulsive people involved in the border peace, who only want to turn Gaza into a techno-futuristic beach resort.
Yeah.
You know, he set up this thing and then he's put people in to try and make it work. And those people are, you know, trying to make the best of a bad job, I think. But the best of a bad job does involve these elements of Palestinian autonomy with international forces trying to restore order. Mm-hmm. Like I say, the only thing that exists that isn't just Israel's endless genocidal extermination of the Palestinian people, waving this promise like the settlers do, that actually, it would just be best, really, if they voluntarily migrated themselves mm-hmm. out of Gaza. It's a prison, and no country is going to step up and take any of these people in just because Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich and the hideous Daniela Weiss. These people insist that other countries, it's their obligation to help out Israel. Because 3,000 years ago, these people who are not from there were told that it was their land. I mean, you know, when is this idiocy ever going to stop, Chris?
Yeah, well, and the ISF, the International Stabilization Forces, haven't arrived at another broken promise, but who they prefer to use for that eventuality that seems pretty remote are Moroccan troops and Kosovar, yeah. Kosovar troops. I mean, I couldn't think of two least apt examples, you know, but there you have it. Andy, sadly, we're fast out of time. It always goes too quickly. Go to Andy's site, andyworthington.co.uk, to read his article, Hamas Agrees to Disarm, but Only if Israel Leaves Gaza, and some of his many other articles and features there. Thanks again for coming on, Andy?
Yeah, well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris. You know, thank you so much for keeping the faith for 30 years.
Almost. Yeah. Oh, my God.
I mean... as we know, the mainstream media hasn't got better over that time, has it?
No.
It's getting worse and worse.
God, what a state of it. You should listen to the first half of this show to get some idea of that. Likewise, thanks go out to Eve Angler, and best wishes for his most recent arrest. And congratulations to Eve for showing that there still is conscience among Canadians. That's all I've got for this week. Until the next time.
Thanks, Chris.